I am amazed, as I read the news, about how things are such a mess. Now, it didn't just happen this week. This has been going on over the years. It's been an ongoing mess. But did you happen to pay attention to the news this week of what's going on? Of course, we had the earthquake in Nepal, the rioting in Baltimore. We have the ongoing, do I dare say, ineptitude and general chaos in the District of Columbia. The constant terrorist threats, the ongoing persecution of Christians, the loss of the rule of law, the loss of respect for authority, the redefinition of marriage, the loss of respect for life, the decline of morality, the increased dependence upon drugs, alcohol, you name it, the increased dependence on China, and on you could go. But that's enough to give you a picture of the dismal state of affairs of the world in which we live. It's always been a mess because it's a fallen world, but there are moments when you look at, you think, wow, do you ever wonder if time is running out? Like a lot? But I had another thought. Does it ever make you concerned that it may not get over soon enough? That it's going to continue for a while, that we've got to deal with this mess. And that's kind of where we are. We don't know how much longer things are going to go. We do have some direction in Scripture, just a reminder of the kinds of things, natural disasters, human-caused disasters, political disasters, of course, most of them are human-caused, moral disasters, judicial disasters, social disasters, etc., etc. And you remember 2 Timothy 3, 1 through 5, and you could go further in that chapter, but this is enough to give us a bit of a picture. But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come. And we'd like to know exactly when is that going to be? Are we there yet? Are we kind of in the process? Or is it down the road a piece? Or then you read the list. You say, well, for men will be lovers of themselves. Is there any narcissism going on today? Lovers of money? Yeah, that might be there. Boasters? Proud? Have you read Facebook? Never mind. Blasphemers? Disobedient to parents? Unthankful? Unholy? Unloving? Unforgiving? Slanderers? Without self-control? If you've ever been on the roads, you know. Brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power. And from such people turn away. Oh my. Where do you turn? What a mess. How do we deal with that? What it does give you a clue to is that there's a fair amount of stuff we've got to deal with in this world. And while we would like to think that the Lord is going to remove us before any of this happens, we do know that we're going to be out of here before the worst of it happens, if our eschatology is correct, and I think it is, from the pre-millennial view of things. But it's kind of a mess. And we have observed within our lifetime, most of us, how there was a time when Christians were the people that one looked to for hope, for direction, for insight, for stability in society. What is the case today? Christians are viewed as the oddball, the troublemaker. The person who causes the problems. The people who aren't flexible, aren't willing to go along with society. We are the scourge of the earth in some people's viewpoint. And I have a hunch that the original readers of Hebrews found themselves in a similar state. And that's part of the reason that the author of Hebrews is writing what he's writing. Let's just take a quick review of the focus on faith in Hebrews 11. Of course, the whole book of Hebrews is on be faithful in the face of whatever it is you've got to deal with. But chapter 11 is the faith chapter, and so we recognize that. We've pointed out that faith is described as confident assurance. That is, you've got to have something upon which to rest your faith, and there needs to be some assurance that that is trustworthy. And, of course, God is the focus of our trust. So we recognize that. Then we had some pre-flood examples of a focus on living in faith. Those whose daily walk was characterized by trusting in God on a daily basis. And we were reminded that is a good thing to focus on, to remember. And then we saw some patriarchal examples, and their focus was on dying in faith, on trusting God even when the things that have been promised haven't been fulfilled yet. And they went to their death not having everything fulfilled. Some were, but many things not. Still anticipating. And so the next section we're going to look at deals with examples from Moses to Jericho. And the focus is on how to live in faith in the presence of opposition and obstacles. We may find ourselves in a similar situation of dealing with opposition and obstacles to maintaining faith in God in today's world. Because that's not the common notion these days. So we want to give some thought to that. So I want us to consider how to stand strong in our faith, in our living faith, against opposition and obstacles. And I want us to think about, well, what are some of the areas of concern that we may face? So let's take a look at Hebrews chapter 11. I want to read through the text just to give us a quick overview, and then we'll look at some of the specifics. Verse 23. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's command. By faith, Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. By faith, he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, lest he who destroyed the firstborn should touch them. By faith they passed through the Red Sea as by dry land, whereas the Egyptians, attempting to do so, were drowned. By faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days. By faith, the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe when she had received the spies with peace. Now, there's a whole pretty good chunk of history right there, and we could spend a lot of time just going through and reviewing what those things are. I'm assuming you either remember enough of that, or you can take your study Bible out and go back and find those places, with the exception of a few places we'll take a look at. But I just want to say, I want to focus on what the intention, I believe, of the author of Hebrews is to deal with this as illustrative for applicational purposes. And so I'm focusing on what is the application of the point that's being made here, rather than just looking at all of the history, because there's plenty of history. But But what I want us to think about ultimately is that the title of the message is Adjusting to Faith, and that has to do with how do we adjust our thinking to the circumstances of life in light of our faith? Because that's kind of what's involved here. So, I think I covered that. Let's come back to Hebrews 11:23. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child. Now, we need to stop there for just a moment. Was that it? I mean, he was a cute. I mean, everybody thinks that yours is the cutest. I mean, just ask Susan about who's the cutest grandbaby she's ever seen. It's the word there is tov. It means good, and it has various expansions on that idea. It can be beautiful, but it can also mean that he was exceptional. There was something special about him. He was I think the old King James may be goodly. I don't recall exactly, but I think that was the case. But good is the idea. He was a special child. There was something about him that the parents may have seen or had some insight. So it might be helpful. It's not just because, wow, he was just such a cute kid. We just couldn't kill this one. It's like, there's got to be more to it than that. And there were several that weren't followed through in that way. And they were not afraid of the king's command. And so, as we think about this, let's just take a second and look at the other phrase here. They were not afraid of the king's command. What does that mean? They were afraid to some degree, but they were willing to deal with the consequences because they thought what they were doing was important enough to do. So that, I think, is helpful to clarify. But what I want us to think about is there is opposition here, the opposition of national government. Now, you don't have to think long and hard about, well, is there any possible application that we could find in this? So think for a moment. Moses was born in a hostile environment. You can go back to Exodus 1:15-22. There was a new law that had just been made, according to verse 16 and verse 22, that we could call selective infanticide. There were certain babies that were expected to be eliminated by the order of the government. They said, the boy babies must die, and you can keep alive the girl babies. Now, we've heard about things in China, similar kinds of things. And this sort of thing has been done before. I think it was done in Rome and other places, other times. So it's not like it's new. It's just always disturbing whenever it is part of the national expectation. And we've had to deal with, since 1973, government-endorsed abortion. And, of course, euthanasia is being legalized and practiced in many places. The law of God, on the other hand, calls for protection of life and respect for life and for the innocent. We're called to help the helpless and preserve life. Our call to respect life also includes capital punishment. And there are some who think, well, how in the world do you put that together? Well, if life is sacred enough and we recognize it, if I take someone's life, then I lose mine. It's that serious. And that would sort of kind of bring back the idea, I guess life is kind of important. So there is a correlation there. And you can check out Genesis 9 and Romans 13 to get the biblical background to that. But we also know we live in an increasingly hostile secular environment. and we have to deal with all kinds of things. Our secular laws are based on an assumption, and this is for the most part the more recent ones, the earlier ones not, but for the most part the later ones assume there is no God. They assume that the secular mindset is neutral. And they assume that theists are biased. Right? But the non-theists are not biased because that's secular, that's neutral. And we've already said a couple of weeks ago, that's not the case. That's not neutrality. That is a position that has been chosen, selected. And then we've got the arguments for same-sex marriage that assume that marriage is a humanly devised institution and therefore it is subject to natural evolution as society sees fit. Things have changed, we got to change with it, and on we go. And therefore the institution of marriage is subservient to social convention and governmental jurisdiction, not God's. Thus, societally designated human rights trump marriage, and it has been said in those terms. And human rights trump religious conviction. That's the argument that's being used today. The laws of the land are the highest authority. It is assumed. And we say, wait a minute, there's another option here. Doesn't God have the ultimate authority? That puts us in a delicate position. We must balance the rule of law and civil disobedience. We believe in the rule of law. Our constitutional republic is set up in that way. And so we value law. We appreciate law. We don't like bad laws. If you can read that little note there from Edmund Burke, bad laws are the worst sort of tyranny. We've had some of those. We have some of those. That's problematic. We face government-sanctioned abortion and euthanasia. We face government rejection of capital punishment. We face government rejection of corporal punishment. We face government-sanctioned promotion and protection of, well, a whole list of things, you name it, homosexuality, pornography, gambling, drug use, and on you go. It's like, well, got to protect that. But we can redefine marriage, don't have to protect that, and on we go. So much of what we hold dear and so much of what the Bible proclaims as the way things ought to be and are being attacked. So we are in a situation where we have to deal with opposition from national, sometimes local, state government. So how do we deal with this? Well, it's interesting when you look at the examples of Scripture. One of the things is to hold firm to our faith convictions no matter what. So if the government says, you do this, what does the Bible say? What do we do? Do we say, okay, let's weigh that. Let's see. Which logically sounds better? Or do we say, well, we know the Bible is true, and we got problems over here. So that ought to tell us something. So that's one thing. Hold firm to your convictions, your biblical understanding on these things. The second element is obey the law as much as possible. That's what Romans 13, Peter reminds us also. Obey the law because we live under rule of law. But when there are occasions when you cannot do so, the general emphasis is quietly resist the law. That seems to be the norm, quietly resist the law. There doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence for protests and rioting in Scripture when there are issues. 1 Timothy 2:2 reminds us to live quiet and peaceful lives in light of our relationship to the government. seems to suggest don't draw too much attention to yourself, but there is an expectation that we have certain parameters within which we live that are such that we ought to engage in the things that our government gives us access to, that we ought to function as much as we can, use our societally given rights wisely, like get out and vote, speak up for what's right and true in the context that is permissible to do so. And that seems to be why the New Testament does not specify rules for society as a whole, because the expectation is for Christians, they're going to be in different nations all around the world. It's different than the Old Testament. The Old Testament had laws in a lot of specific areas that related to the basic things of life because it was a nation. And so there were expectations for finance and governing of things and how to deal with mildew and mold and health issues. And I mean, everything was covered under the Mosaic Law because it was a nation. And that was their constitution. They needed something to give them guidance. But for us, as believers, we're in all kinds of different nations. So we've got to deal with the nation that we're in. So that ought to temper our thinking. We have the rule of law, and then we have civil disobedience when it is impossible to follow the law. And so it's a delicate situation. There does come a time, but the emphasis seems to be not to cause a huge fuss, necessarily, but to quietly resist. Now, there may be some occasions when there are when it's forced upon us to have to be more belligerent. But the general emphasis is to be at peace and function within the parameters that you have to deal with. So that's a challenge. We will have to deal with that. There are many who are having to deal with it now. There are those who are going to court because of various applications of laws in certain contexts that you're probably well aware of. And there is a proper way to do that, to go to law in that context. So then coming to the next few verses here. By faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. That could include sins of omission as well as commission, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. Now, if you're paying attention at all, it might kind of jump out at you, esteeming the reproach of Christ. Let's see. Moses was in the Old Testament. Christ was in the New Testament. How is he doing that? Hold that thought. We're going to get back to that. First, the obstacle of golden opportunity. Now, I know you're thinking, what? A golden opportunity? And you say, that's an obstacle? How can that possibly be an obstacle? Moses enjoyed a most privileged position. That was truly a golden opportunity, probably with gold involved as well. He had every material provision available. I mean, we're talking Egypt. He had the best educational opportunity, which God used to prepare him for what was to come. He had one of the highest positions in the land, Prince of Egypt. Wasn't there a movie by that name? I mean, how can you beat that? I mean, it is a Cinderella story par excellence. I mean, this is like, wow. This is a golden opportunity. And he blew it. He just completely, like, what a dope. What were you thinking? And he got thrown out of the place. But think for a moment. compare. We have greater material provision than Moses. Even in our toughest situations, we have running water. We have toilets. We have washing machines. They didn't have that stuff back then. I mean, they had some variation of it, but you wouldn't think of it as top of the line. I mean, we have more food options. I mean, you go to the grocery store and you freak out because, like, what in the world? How am I going to choose? We have climate control, and we gripe like crazy when it isn't just right. Well, one or two of you do. You know who you are. Our transportation capability, our communication, I mean, all the stuff that we have. I mean, do we have a golden opportunity? I mean, we have so much, and we still whine and complain. Like, Lord, if you just gave us a little bit more, I think we could be more effective at reaching the world for Christ. I've given you everything. I mean, you've got Bibles enough to, you know, do your floor with them. So why are you complaining? Our educational opportunities, even our status compared to the rest of the world. So Moses sacrificed his position out of concern for his own people. His defense of another Israelite cost him his position. If he had just minded his own business, everything would have been fine and he could have stayed as the prince of Egypt. But there was something in him. God was at work. Now, you have to struggle with this just a little bit. He ultimately accepted God's call to lead the people out of slavery. But how long did it take to prepare him for that? 80 years. He got the education and training that he needed for dealing with Egypt, the first 40 years. He got the training and education he needed for dealing with the desert, the second 40 years. That's 80 years of training. It's not surprising that when God called him, he said, "Get Aaron," just like we would do. He'd already had kind of a tough situation. So he had a golden opportunity that he let go because of a concern for his own people that had to have been a God-given concern. And yet he did something that probably wasn't on God's list of things to do. He didn't get a memo that said, okay, by the way, there's this Egyptian that's going to kill this Israelite. I want you to knock him off here at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. So was Moses still responsible for his action? Absolutely. And what happened as a result? Banishment. So he paid a consequence. We deal with golden opportunities too. And sometimes those golden opportunities take our eyes off of dependence upon God. What would Moses be known for if he had not taken out that Egyptian who was beating the Israelite slave? What would he have gone down for in history? Well, we don't know. Can't say for sure. He may have been just a nobody, just a spoiled kid in Egypt. Like we have spoiled kids in our country. playing video games or whatever they had back then. Sometimes golden opportunities are not a good thing, and we need to be very cautious and considered in our thinking when we deal with those. We need to evaluate them carefully, because the easy life can be a great obstacle to faith, because there's just very little reason to have to trust God, because we've got everything we need. Now, I have to tell you a quick story, and I'm not planning to get all the way through, in case you're wondering, today. This Friday evening, Friday afternoon, we went down to visit Emily and Chris in Las Cruces. And after dinner, we went to see some homes, because they like to check out the homes when it's the showcase of homes. And my dad was a carpenter in construction most of his life, so I can't help but like to see them in process or in completion. And so they took us to a couple of homes on the west side of Las Cruces. Picacho Hills, I think it's called, if you're familiar with the area. And whenever you say hills, it means it kind of goes up, and it's on the west side, and it looks out over the city of Las Cruces, and then you can see the Oregon Mountains, and it's quite a spectacular view. So the first house we saw was only about $800,000, and I thought, now that is pretty impressive. That is pretty nice. Somebody did some nice work here. This is quite spectacular. And they had all kinds of cool stuff, like an indoor courtyard and whatnot. But they didn't have a pool, and I thought, well, what? You got all this, you don't have a pool? What are you thinking? And so then we went to the next house, which was just barely a block away or so. And it sat up just a little bit higher, and it was a little bit bigger. It had a pool, had an infinity pool even. And this incredible, and it was a $1.2 million house. I don't know if I've been in one of those. It was very impressive. And I thought, this is really nice. It would be really nice to just sit here and enjoy this view. But I tried to think about living in a house like that. It's too big. There's just too much work to do. I mean, you'd spend all your time trying to keep the place up. Well, unless you had enough cash that you could hire somebody to do all that for you. But it seems to me that if you spent $1.2 million, you wouldn't have anything left to do, and you'd have to do it all yourself. But that's me thinking. Then a little later, we saw another house that was a little more in a range that was actually reasonable. But I thought, you know, what does a person do in a $1.2 million house that you can't do in a $150,000 house? I mean, you get up in the morning, you eat breakfast, you get your shower, whatever, and you got to go to work, and then you come back, and you got to do the stuff that you normally. It's like, okay, it's got a nice view. Okay, that's good. I like nice views. That's why I like to bicycle. I can see some nice views. But really, how much trust in the Lord does one have when you have a $1.2 million house? Even an $800,000 house. It's just staggering. I mean, you can do everything you need to do in a small apartment. We've done that. I know what that's like. Just to live life, it can be a distraction from trust in God to have everything we've ever wanted. Couldn't it? Isn't it? Now, not everybody has to struggle with that difficulty of dealing with the golden opportunity. Many of you are still thinking, I'm kind of still waiting on that. Like, when is it going to show up? So then you think, okay, what am I doing with what I have now? How am I living? Am I trusting God with what I have, no matter what it is? Is there anything in your life that forces you to trust God daily? Our inclination is to complain and whine and fuss and worry about those things. The very things that God may be allowing so that we will call out to Him and say, God, help me. I don't wish that on anybody to have to deal with those kinds of things, but it might be helpful to be reminded that, when those troubles come to my life, maybe God is wanting me to say, okay, maybe I should be looking up on those occasions. Well, then there's that other thing we had mentioned. How did Moses esteem the reproach of Christ as greater riches than the treasures of Egypt? Well, first of all, you need to recognize this is probably to be understood as an applicational analogy for the readers, because they were living at a time where they recognized who Christ was, and they could look back and so they could see the relationship. But there's also a sense in which Moses was serving Christ. For instance, who was it that he saw in the burning bush? It was the angel of the Lord. That's a theophany. That's a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. So did he have any kind? Was Christ in the Old Testament? Certainly was. So that's not that hard to imagine, though I still think it's probably an applicational analogy that is being communicated there. So the picture, then, is are we prepared to set aside potential opportunities for self-advantage, for complete dedication to Christ? Am I prepared to do that? Are we prepared to bypass the pleasures of sin for total devotion to Christ, a fully faithful commitment to Him? It seems there may be fewer who are willing to do that, who are prepared to do that, to say, okay, I'm going to forego something that could be just really wonderful for me, because I think Christ wants me to be totally devoted to Him. And if I pursue this thing in my life, that's going to consume me, and I'm not going to be as interested in Him. Is that a possibility? I think it is. And you need to evaluate. You need to think about. Am I willing to forgo something that seems so wonderful for me for the sake of devotion to Christ or the benefit of someone else? Am I prepared for that?